You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Carolyn Vanderweel.
And I'm Ryan Stacey. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, June 23rd, 2016.
I don't know that there are any good measures to understand that a hospital has overprescribed. I think there is a cultural or really sort of a philosophical shift within medicine.
Hospitals are adopting new guidelines aimed at reducing addiction to painkillers. More on that later in the show in today's WFHB Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, our weekly public opinion feature, Voices in the Street, asks about gun laws in the United States. But first, these local headlines.
In its meeting last night, the City Council had its first round of discussions about an electrical substation slated for the northwest corner of Rogers and West 11th Streets. Duke Energy is petitioning the city to vacate four rights of way contained in the 2.7-acre area. The Bloomington Board of Public Works has already given its approval for the project. Duke Energy's attorney, William Beggs, said the company is making an effort to be a good neighbor.
And so we want to make sure that we at least get across the fact that we have attempted to hear concerns about in the community and in the neighborhood in particular, and we have responded to that by making significant commitments with equipment, low noise equipment, low profile equipment, and a screening plan that is unlike anything Duke has done.
Maple Heights resident Lucy Shake, who was also a volunteer at WFHB, spoke on behalf of 560 residents who signed a petition asking Duke to relocate the substation. She said there are concerns Duke has not addressed in its most recent plans.
You've already heard the specifics of what is being proposed for the site by the petitioner, but I do want to point out what has not been proposed, and that includes no sound mitigation of that decibel level, 62 decibels at the transformer. Those do run 24/7, and that is a concern to our neighbors. There's no visual barrier on the backside of the substation to protect neighbors who will be within 200 feet. And only a partial berm as a visual break on the front peak of the corner site, and that berm immediately tapers to the ground before the extent of the full property. So we're concerned that there is not a 360-degree protection to this site.
Shake cited the ongoing growth on IU's campus on the city's east side, which is roughly 2 miles away from the proposed substation site, as further reason to question Duke's choice of a location. Shake said there were other sites that could support the needs of both the eastward expansion and the downtown area. Councilmember Susan Sandberg asked about the possibility of a public-private partnership to make the site more compatible with Bloomington's values and urban style while retaining affordability for Duke. Duke's district manager, Bruce Calloway, said, quote, "We'd be willing to see if we could work toward a win-win on that," unquote. Councilmember Andy Ruff said he didn't think Duke was thinking creatively enough and asked Beggs whether vacating the four rights of way requested was absolutely necessary to build the substation. Beggs responded.
That strikes my ear as two questions. Does it need the vacations of the rights of way of these remnants in order to build a substation at this location of critical need in the community? It does not. The second question I hear is, does Duke need the vacations of those rights of way, those remnant rights of way, in order to include the screening solution or a screening solution that it has proposed? Yes, it does.
Beggs said if the City Council denied Duke's request to vacate the rights of way, the company could go ahead with building the substation. He emphasized, however, that Duke was, quote, "engaging in the process," unquote, in an effort to find a palatable solution. The City Council will hold a second meeting to further discuss the issue and give its final vote.
The organization Visit Bloomington has just published two new travel guides for the Monroe County area. One guide focuses on the three major lakes in the county, while the other provides LGBTQ-specific travel information. Visit Bloomington's Director of Tourism, Julie Warren, says that although these guides are aimed at visitors to the area, the guides are also meant to provide information to locals who are interested in the subject matter.
our goal, of course, is to try to get visitors here and to give them information. So all of our stuff is really geared towards people who either haven't been here or maybe are still looking for information, even if they have been here. And so it is geared towards visitors. However, we have a ton of locals and residents who use the brochures and say, oh, you know, I maybe knew about Lake Monroe, but I didn't know about all the amenities that are available at Lake Lemon or, you know, something like that.
Visit Bloomington has released these visitor guides since 2008, but Warren says this year they have undergone a dramatic change. Each guide not only includes information such as facts and figures about the area, but also themed trip ideas and recommendations for lodging. The hope is that these guides will encourage visitors to explore more of Monroe County and extend their visits.
There's a lot of this curated content that we hadn't really provided before. It was a lot of just facts and figures and information and phone numbers and all that stuff. But we decided that visitors want a little bit more than that. And we want to make sure that they know about all the cool things that they can do. And so it's just trying to provide that information and resource so that they're staying longer, coming more often, and experiencing more things.
Visit Bloomington releases a variety of niche guides throughout the year, covering topics such as the limestone architecture on IU's campus and the Tibetan Cultural Center. Warren says the organization hopes to portray all of the exciting things Monroe County has to offer.
We think of Bloomington as progressive, it's welcoming, it's open-minded. There's a lot of variety and diversity in Bloomington, and so we want to portray all of those different angles. And it's tough because there are so many things to talk about, from the arts to the outdoors, which may seem completely different, but for our audiences, that's what makes Bloomington great.
The Lakes and LGBT visitor guides can be downloaded from the website visitbloomington.com. Hard copies can be requested online or found at the Visitor Center, located at 2855 North Walnut Street.
Cook Medical has partnered with the Broadview Learning Center and Ivy Tech Community College to create two new education initiatives for Cook employees. My Cook Pathway is a program that allows new employees to work part-time while earning their high school equivalency at Broadview Learning Center. Until recently, people could not work for Cook Medical if they did not have a high school diploma. Now employees are allowed to work part-time until they've acquired their high school equivalency. The individual can be offered a full-time position after completion of the program. Director of Education Rob Moore says that this new program is not only beneficial to the employee, but to Cook as well.
For Cook Medical, it's really good for them because what we've done with them now is created a pipeline for people to get employment. They can try them out at Cook and see if they work out as employees, get into the training program for their high school equivalency, and then have a nice pipeline of employees who qualify for jobs that they are trying to fill.
Cook has also launched a new program with Ivy Tech called Achieve Your Degree. The program allows for Cook employees to earn certificates while they're working at Cook. There are 7 certificate programs that employees can choose from, and after completion, individuals can go on to finish their associate's degree. The chancellor for Bloomington's Ivy Tech campus, Jenny Vaughn, says they have seen a great interest in the Achieve Your Dream program from Cook employees.
We've been very purposeful. We have gone to Cook and in their atrium and have been in there. I believe by the middle of July, we will have people enrolled, and I expect at least 100 people, if not more, to start in the fall.
Cook Medical will be paying the cost for both the My Cook Pathway and Achieve Your Degree programs. Mariah Souders of Cook Medical says that Cook listened to employees about the financial aspect of these programs.
We've done a lot of listening with our employees, and we heard that a lot of folks want to continue their careers at Cook and expand their opportunities, and we heard that there were some barriers with that financial piece, so that's why we redesigned and wanted to provide those opportunities for our employees to be able to advance their careers. And with having open positions, we know there's a lot of great talent in this region. And sometimes folks just may not have been eligible for a job in the past because of an educational barrier. So this is a great way to help people in the area who would be a great fit for Cook in order to qualify for those positions.
Employees that participate in these programs will begin this fall. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Ryan Stacey.
And I'm Carolyn Vandeweel. This week, Governor Mike Pence's Task Force on Drug Enforcement, Treatment, and Prevention endorsed a new set of guidelines for how emergency rooms treat acute pain. According to the governor's office, the guidelines are part of a larger strategy aimed at reducing drug abuse in the state. News Director Joe Crawford spoke with a representative of Indiana's hospitals, and we bring you that conversation now. for today's WFHB Community Report.
Reporting for WFHB, I'm Joe Crawford. I'm joined on the phone by Brian Tabor. He is the Executive Director of the Indiana Hospital Association. Brian, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
So we're talking today because the Indiana Hospital Association, along with the Indiana State Medical Association, has put together some guidelines for managing pain in emergency departments or emergency rooms in Indiana. What we're talking about here, at least in part, I believe, is the prescription of opioids, such as, for example, OxyContin. Is that right?
That's right. The guidelines that we've developed do also address other controlled substances. Certainly the focus is on opioids.
And as a lot of folks know, there is an opioid epidemic in Indiana as well as in a lot of other places around the country. The number of overdose deaths from prescription pain relievers has increased a lot in the United States over the past couple of decades. And a lot of folks who start out with prescription painkillers do eventually turn to heroin, which is cheaper. And recently, a lot of people are blaming this increase on the overprescription of painkillers, which are addictive oftentimes. In a press release this week, Indiana's State Health Commissioner Jerome Adams was quoted as saying that the national opioid epidemic is largely a product of overprescribing and a long-standing belief that patients should experience no pain, unquote. So, Brian, can you tell us what exactly led the Hospital Association to decide that it needed to come up with new guidelines for treating pain in emergency rooms?
Well, I think given the backdrop that you've just described, the epidemic that we've seen nationally, and then clearly it's been highlighted by events that have taken place even here in our own state of Indiana, the outbreak of HIV in Scott County, which was linked to the IV use of pain medication, and certainly there are other instances, hot spots across the state where we've seen this problem emerge. And so it's very much on the front burner of hospital CEOs, medical professionals, public policymakers. So it's something that we've been working on for some time. Individually, many of our facilities, independent community hospitals, large health systems, have been developing their own guidelines and implementing new policies and procedures designed to incentivize and kind of standardize the appropriate prescription of pain medication across facilities. And so as the association that represents almost every hospital in the state of Indiana, we looked to the various models that our members were developing, as well as some of the national best practices. We tried to pull out what we thought were kind of the best elements of all of those variations on emergency room prescribing guidelines and put that together in one document. So I think what it really can do is help medical professionals across the state kind of standardize their own policies, even for some that already have good policies in place. It provides kind of a second opinion so that they can go and review what they've already done. And there's another element to this as well. These guidelines, I think, will help prescribers, but as part of this effort, we're going to be putting out some material that we think can be very helpful to patients, educational material for patients to understand alternatives for treatment of pain other than opioids.
So as you say, the Hospital Association represents nearly every hospital in Indiana. Do you think that hospitals have overprescribed painkillers over the years? And if so, why?
I don't know that there are any good measures or baseline measures to understand, you know, how one would determine that a hospital has overprescribed. I think there is a cultural or really sort of a philosophical shift within medicine that Dr. Adams is alluding to today that was driven by, I think, a real focus in medical education and training on treating pain in a very specific way, and there certainly has been a large increase in the prescription of opioids for pain. But I think, you know, when you look at across the country, this is certainly not anything that's unique to any one individual hospital or Indiana alone. This is really just a trend that sort of emerged within medicine, and to some degree, the expectation of patients.
And so you're kind of describing it as a cultural issue or a trend that developed in medicine. Were there or are there any economic incentives? Are there reasons economically why doctors would be inclined to prescribe painkillers?
I don't know about economically. I think that there's a demand factor. You know, I think an expectation that has built up with consumers, and people understand that there are medications that were available to treat their pain. I think the incentive is always within medicine to treat the patient, both their medical complication, their injury, whatever it is that someone comes to a hospital for, whether it's the emergency room or seeking a surgery. Pain, and some have referred back to kind of the evolution or noted the rise of pain as the fifth vital sign, and that's arguable the how significant that concept is in the rise of prescribing. But certainly it has received some attention. So this idea that as physicians and medical practitioners look to treat an individual's symptoms, their injury, but also the level of pain they're experiencing. There have been many of these new opioids that were developed that came on the market, and they, in some cases and in most cases, appropriately prescribed. Now, there's sort of another element that's perhaps different from what I'm talking about here and just the practice of medicine, but with the rise, the greater availability of some of these drugs, there are instances where people have sought them, have become addicted, and inappropriately seeking those. And I think by establishing some of these guidelines, we're really kind of focusing more on, you know, one, eliminating that, you know, reducing the availability of these drugs to someone who may be seeking them without a true, you know, medical condition.
So I wanted to ask about how these will be implemented. They read kind of basically like recommendations, you know, they say prescription should not typically be provided in certain situations, or that emergency clinicians should consider searching the state's prescription monitoring database before prescribing certain medications. Do you think that the doctors who have, you know, so much training, years and years and years of training, will they listen to these recommendations?
Well, I think so. They were developed by physicians with a tremendous amount of input from physicians across the state. We developed these guidelines in partnership with the Indiana State Medical Association. They've been supported by the Indianapolis Coalition for Patient Safety, the Indiana chapter of the College of Emergency Room Physicians. So we've had a lot of medical professional input into developing these. So yes, I think absolutely they will be looked at very closely, and I think they'll be adopted widely.
I've been speaking with Brian Tabor. He is the executive director of the Indiana Hospital Association. Brian, thanks again for talking with us.
Thank you very much for reaching out to the association.
The full list of guidelines can be found online at in.gov/GTFDETP.
Support for WFHB comes from Monster Digital Marketing, offering digital marketing solutions for small businesses. Monster Digital Marketing websites are built for search engine optimization with both the desktop and the mobile device user in mind. Located at monsterdigitalmarketing.com or on the phone at 317-567-1197.
Up next is our weekly public opinion segment, Voices in the Street.
Welcome to Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion feature. Voices in the Street provides an opportunity for people in our community to share their opinions and perspectives on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. This week on Voices in the Street, the Pulse Massacre, America's Right to Bear Arms. Omar Mateen killed 49 people and injured 53 more at Orlando's Pulse nightclub. The horrific act marks another mass shooting for the United States,
So Voices in the Street hit the streets of downtown Bloomington to find out what people think about current gun control laws.
I would admittedly say that I'm torn, definitely conflicted, because, for example, Orlando, the most recent tragedy that struck our country, makes me want to be a strong advocate against. However, I think about my mom and how she's young, she's old, and she carries a gun in her apartment because she's been robbed, and she feels like that is her security. So I think it's situational, but I'd rather lean towards a strict kind of responsible law.
Well, I think the gun control laws that we have should be enforced, and I think we should have sensible gun control laws so that people who are known to have mental issues or known to be on a terrorist watch list or known to be watched by the FBI shouldn't be able to go in and go buy an assault rifle. I think it's ludicrous that Congress is so controlled by the NRA that they're unable to act and make sensible reform. The technology exists to make some guns safer so that you can register a gun to your fingerprint so that if you have a gun in the house, some child doesn't pick it up and accidentally shoot someone. And the NRA is against that. It's really kind of foolish. Why not use this technology?
I think sometimes those people who hold their guns and the Second Amendment so tightly to themselves and don't want any progress, I just feel like you're really missing the mark and not taking a step back and looking at the whole picture. There's got to be somewhere in the middle. Where's the common sense? Why does everything have to be so extreme, so black and white? Where's the common sense? Where's the middle ground?
I think the people decide on a local basis over the state to state.
Oh dear, that's a really complicated question because I understand those who like to be hunters, etc., and for them it's a sport and they would never abuse it, but yet there obviously are a lot of people who abuse it constantly. So I don't know, how do we legislate one without hurting the other one? I don't obviously have a great answer. I just have more questions, okay?
I think that everyone has a right to own their own gun. I think that there should be regulation on automatic weapons and like assault rifles and things like that. But I definitely think that when it comes to gun control, they have to take into consideration there's a lot of hate out there and people use guns for bad things. Like a lot of times people like to use the saying that like, you know, guns don't kill people, people kill people, but a lot of times it's people with guns. And so I definitely think that going into this next election, gun control is definitely something that needs to be talked about and finally addressed.
Long overdue. There's not much else to be said.
This has been Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion segment, featuring candid commentary from your friends and neighbors on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. Voices in the Street is a volunteer-powered production of our News and Public Affairs Department here on WFHB 91.3 and 98.1 FM, community radio for South Central Indiana.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Casey Ross and Taylor Haggerty, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Joe Crawford.
Voices in the Street was produced by Kelly Worley. Our engineer today is Chris Martin. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, this is Ryan Stacey.
And I'm Carolyn Vandeweel. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, independent daily news program.
Stay tuned for Blooming Out, Indiana's only LGBTQI public affairs show, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.